8:16 a.m. The wheels are turning slowly.
Yeah.
Faster than the speed of light.
Starts with a C. It's not continuity. It's
like a causality paradox.
Causality. There we go. Thank you.
Causality is weird. You know the whole theoretical thing about if you were theoretically able to travel back in time and change events, that other events would still have to occur to make future outcomes stay the same.
Oh, yes. The final destination paradox.
Wait, hang on. Is final destination secretly the most like theoretically physically accurate time travel thing out there?
The idea of final destination is that if you cheat death one way, death will get you some other way. That's more more amazing.
Sound backing in physics in the Final Destination series.
Look, it's a little bit like between that and the butterfly effect featuring Ashton the Cooch Coocher. I feel like we're like 90% of the way to like none of that Back to the Future bullshit time travel stuff, like actual real quantum physics time travel.
Maybe we should get Professor Kutcher on this podcast.
I think he's available. He's probably promoting that 90s show or something now. So, I mean, I guess he's around. Is that a real thing? Somebody was talking about that the other day. I didn't even bother to look it up. I just assumed.
Is that a thing? That is a thing.
Wow, really?
That's a thing. That's a thing. It's coming out.
Is it all of them? Let me guess. It's all of them, but Danny Masterson.
Hang on. Let's see. Well, I hope it's at least not him.
Yeah.
Kurtwood Smith. I don't know all the actors' names. Okay. Laura Prepon is in here.
Yeah.
Topher Grace.
Yeah.
Looks like Oh, no. Okay. I see what happened here. The parents are the same.
Okay.
All the kids are guest stars.
Oh, so they're transitioning to be about the grandkids.
Yeah. So like Topher Grace is one episode. Mila Kunis is one episode. Don't see Ashton Kutcher on here at all. He's too busy at university.
I wonder what's going to happen. Like, what's the drug of choice in the 90s? In the 70s, it makes sense. They're all sitting in the basement smoking weed. But like weed was hard to get in the 90s.
Man, what was the drug of the 90s? Like the drug of the 8 Coke was definitely the drug of the 80s.
I think cheap Coke was the drug of the 90s where I grew up. I didn't ever do that. It was bad.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ate mushrooms toward the end of the 90s.
Okay, sure. Yes. Okay. I'd say psychedelic, like the rise of the Fish, Dave Matthews, jam band kind of.
Yeah, there were a lot of jam bands.
The Lollapalooza to Bonnaroo to et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, okay, that's it, sure.
Look, the kids these days can't understand this, but there was a period of time when everybody was into jam bands.
Maybe not everybody.
Brad, everybody was into jam. Like, you couldn't not be into jam bands because they were everywhere. You'd go to the grocery store and they'd be playing a damn Dave Matthews song.
What jam? Was I into a jam band and without realizing it?
I mean, I don't know. Do you like Widespread Panic?
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, yeah. You're a little younger than me. Widespread Panic played a lot of do you remember the Horde Festival? That was the jam band. It was like Lollapalooza for jam bands.
Right.
Yeah. Like you'd get Blues Traveler and Widespread Panic would headline that.
Now, you know, okay. Blues Traveler is
fine. What about Hootie? You got a Hootie jam.
I think Blues Traveler is like jam band adjacent maybe, but they're. Look, that harmonica is not that's all right.
Let me tell you, if you see, like, I saw Blues Traveler live a couple of times. Blues Traveler on an album that was produced for the MTV generation, not a jam band. Blues Traveler live, John Popper sit there with that harmonica for 20 minutes. No hesitation.
That sounds great. You know what I started to say? I was just starting to Google John Popper because I always thought he was kind of fun as a frontman figure, but I don't know. I've got a certain hunch. Maybe I shouldn't.
I feel like he
might be right there on the bubble of like.
Oh, you think he's a MAGA guy?
You don't want to know what this guy's politics are.
Oh, the Meatloaf / Morrissey connection.
Oh God, yeah, Morris. Okay, we have to end this.
So anyway, I'm glad to know that you're a fan of jam bands too, Brad. Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
I got a little bit of a cold, Brad, so if I sound weird, I apologize.
You're doing well. Like you let me hear the cough or the sniffle or something before this, and then I was like, oh yeah, that's a cold. But
yeah, the doze is a little dopped up.
You're hiding it well.
Yeah.
You're soldiering on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it, look, it's not as, as colds go, relatively minor. So,
yeah, just, you know, if I, I'm sure you're the same. I would be thankful just for it to be a cold.
Yeah.
At this point, like after the last 3 years, it's like, if I'm going to get a sick, just give me a cold. I'm fine with it. Like, hey, I'll deal with the cold all day long.
Well, yeah, we had some kids over for sleepover last weekend. And then one of them had to cancel at the last minute because she had the Rona. And then my daughter started getting a sniffle at the end of the weekend. And we're like, oh, crap. And we tested her multiple times. So she's like, according to the antibody test, she's clean. But then somebody at school got sick and they were like, well, they were negative on antibody test, but they were positive when we did a PCR. So now we're like, shit, do we have to go get a PCR? That's not what we want. But anyway, here we are. We're podcasting. I don't feel like I have the last time I had the Rona, I knew something was bad was wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
I feel probably OK. I feel pretty OK right now. I feel like I have the sniffles. So
that's good. Fingers crossed.
Brad, it is that time of month again.
It's the most wonderful time
of the month.
Yeah,
we're turning Q's into A's or emails into answers. If you have an email, as always, you can send it to techpod@content.town. That's techpod@content.town.
Do you think the answer conversion quotients of emails and Discord questions is the same? Do they both output the same quantity of answer?
I think the quantity of cues submitted via email is significantly lower than the cues submitted via Discord.
Do we have any mathematicians on the Discord that can help us work? Or maybe that's more of a material science thing, right? It's like an alloy thing.
Like how, what's the ratio? Like
an email yields a 0.8% pure answer compared to a 1.0 from a Discord queue. What am I talking about?
The thing I will say is that the hit percentage on emails versus queues is very high.
Sure.
If you send an email, much better chance of getting it read, because typically we get a relatively small number of emails and a lot of queues.
Yeah.
Mostly from cake batter.
they're mostly good. I think we could probably do an all cake batter one of these at some point if we wanted. But if somebody's going to go to the trouble of opening an email client or web browser.
Yeah.
And typing an address in and everything, they probably have some intention to their question versus some of the drive-by shit posting, let's say, that takes place in the Discord channel. Well,
I mean, yeah, like at this point, if I get an email from someone, I'm like, wow, this person really loves me. They like if when my family members or something sends an email, I'm like, wow, they really care. It's like it's almost as good as like opening a piece of paper and writing like with handwriting a letter at this point. We got like a shocking we give cake batter some grief here. But through the trials of fire and flame, their question asking prowess has grown until I immediately greenlit three cake batter questions this month, probably.
This question about the brown rat stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah.
There's a visual to it. I don't know if we'll be able to take it on here, but
I learned some stuff.
Yeah.
I had to do some looking up. Anyway, we should start turning some Q's and A's. Yeah.
Why don't you take the emails and then we'll get into the Discord
queues.
I evolved my methodology this month. I don't know if you noticed.
No.
We go through bold questions that we want to take.
Yep.
I started highlighting mine in yellow instead.
Ooh, I thought about highlighting.
Now I know which one is one that I flagged and which one is one that you flagged.
I learned last night that Google Docs is bad at working with the keyboard on the iPad. That's the thing I learned, because I couldn't select all the emails. Like in Discord, what we usually do is just select all the emails and drag them down and then paste them into a big long Google Doc and format accordingly. And that was impossible to do on an iPad. So I had to go sit down on the real computer and then highlight stuff on the iPad. Anyway,
do you mean the physical bolt-on keyboard?
Yeah, the bolt-on keyboard.
Interesting. I figured that would just kind of replicate laptop functionality top to bottom.
I think it requires some sort of support on the app basis in order for it to work with the touchpad. Anyway,
sure.
First email comes from Fernando. From Xander. Fernando sent a very nice email, and thank you for Fernando. It was just kind and actually, I'll do the Fernando one too. Yeah, like at this point, I've shouted out Fernando. I got to read the email. I just finished having a really great talk with another member of the Discord, and it was a point of realization that the TechPod Discord is the only server I'm in where every single member seems to be a genuinely nice person. All my interactions have been knowledgeable, generous, good people, and it makes me wonder if this is by design, and what are the steps you both take to attract this kind of person in your community? I'm generally grateful for putting together such a wonderful community. Like, this sounds like an ad for the TechPod Discord.
Sure does.
But it was, I thought it was a really nice email. And like, it doesn't happen by accident. Like, Brad and I are exceptional people.
That's right.
We're just wondering. No.
Who could achieve anything but excellence when they follow in our wake?
No. I think part of it is that we're old, honestly.
Sure. Yes.
So we don't have the 14-year-old angry 14-year-olds have kind of weeded out of the community and mellowed.
Yeah. I think there are younger people. There are people in their 20s mm-hmm. on the Discord, but you know, I think we
have a couple of teenagers, I think, even.
Yeah, but like generally, I would say the average age is a little older, definitely old enough where most people are just over that bullshit.
Yeah.
And also the paywall helps.
I mean, it is like, a low paywall.
It's low, but like that's been my experience with forums and all sorts of stuff over the years. If there's a little bit of a barrier to entry, it's really going to filter out a lot of people who are looking to stir up shit.
Yeah. The other thing is Brad and I, one of the reasons Brad and I are friends is that we're both of the anti-drama contingent of the internet. Like, we're early mm-hmm. members of that club, and as a result, I think we've attracted people that want to come listen to our bullshit that are less into the drama and more into the content. So anyway, I really wanted to put this in there as a shout out to the people in the Discord, because for me, this is a note from Fernando that is as much about how awesome the people in the Discord are as it is much more about that than about us. So good job. Yes. Everybody.
Yeah,
you made Fernando sure. happy. Anyway, Xander says, on a stream the other night, Will mentioned the imminent arrival of his home assistant, Yellow. He also mentioned starting from scratch. Two questions regarding how you envision rebooting your connected home. One, are you planning on moving one device over at a time or just going buck wild and doing the whole thing at once? Two, what are you looking forward to doing differently now that you have years of experience managing your existing environment? So this is a good question. I thought, hey, I started this up when I started doing this. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I figured maybe I'll just start from scratch and do it the way I would want to do it. And then I sat down and looked at what I'd done and where I've gotten over the years with the integration. And I was like, man, it'd be a lot of work to do this whole thing from scratch. So I deleted a couple of scenes that I don't use. I got rid of some old automations that I don't use. I cleared out a bunch of old integrations that no longer have any devices attached to them. And then I just backed it up and backed up the Zigbee radio on the old device and plugged the Zigbee radio into the new device and restored the backup and then migrated the radio over. And it is exactly like it was before. And it was an incredibly easy transition. Like,
that's cool.
Yeah. And it runs on power over Ethernet. So I just plugged it in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I plugged it into the PoE port, one of the PoE ports on the switch in my hall closet. And it's just working in there in the middle of the house where like the radio works really well and everything. So
that's rad.
Yeah, I'm super stoked about it. It's really fun.
Yeah, we should talk more about that thing. I would love to hear more in depth, perhaps on a coming project episode.
Yeah, either a project. Like, I feel like doing a real actual episode about it was I initially thought we'd do a real episode about it, but I don't know that there's a whole lot to talk about other than it's really fast compared to the Pi 3 version because it uses a CM4 a compute module for a Pi 4 and it was like it is a really tidy little piece of hardware, so
it's cool.
Consider it endorsed, I guess.
Cool. I live in fear of losing my home assistant configuration because just setting all that stuff up again. It doesn't help that my girlfriend decided to name all the smart plugs in the house like joke names rather than anything remotely identifiable. So if I lose the association that's already in there of like, oh, this is the one that controls the fan, it's going to take some doing to figure out what is where.
Wait, is the joke name themed based on what the thing that it's plugged into does? Like, is the fan have a nimbus?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. No.
The thing I will say is that I do the backups that get saved. Like I have the plugin from the community store that just saves backups directly to my Google Drive.
Oh, wow.
And so there's a folder in my Google Drive called Home Assistant Backups, and they all just automatically get uploaded there and then deleted from the Home Assistant.
Huh. I need to look into that stuff. I'm still running Home Assistant Core, which lacks a bunch of features. Like, for one thing, it lacks kind of settings export. Like, I have to just copy the config directory out of the home directory of the user that's running it.
Well, so
to migrate.
The
and I don't know. I think the store might be another thing I might not have access to. I'm not sure.
I was going
to
say the challenge now is that the YAML config.yaml doesn't actually hold all the configuration anymore. So a lot of the apps that install, like the you go through an install process, don't save their config files in the config.yaml. So you need to do that backup. You should be able to export the backup. The backup's just a tar. And okay. You should be able to just grab that and put that someplace safe and then you'll be fine. But it literally, I set it, I plugged it in. I was like, oh, I'll noodle with this a little bit. I downloaded the Raspberry Pi OS installer, which one of the options for which OS you want to install is a home assistant install for the Raspberry Pi Yellow. And it was like, which version do you have? Are you doing it on an NVMe? Are you putting it on just the eMMC on the CM4? And I put on the MMC on the CM4. The MMC is like a flash card that's built into the compute module.
Too early for this many acronyms.
I know it's a lot, but it works. Like it worked out of the box. Like it took.
That's cool.
It was like, hey, the lights will stop blinking when the install's done. And the lights stopped blinking, and I went to the IP address and it just like started working. It was
like
I was really impressed.
I'm guessing you can't just buy those things yet, right?
I ordered mine whenever we had Paulus on the FOSS pod. Which if you haven't heard, it's a real good episode. He talks about Matter and all sorts of stuff about Home Assistant Yellow and all that. So it was like 6 months ago, probably. I think they're shipping, like they weren't in production when I ordered it. So they're now caught up with like pre-orders as of last June.
Oh yeah, actually. Yeah. This totally says limited items in stock. So there are.
It's probably harder to get options. The CM. Like I had a hard time getting the CM4.
Yeah. That's cool. I might have to think about that at some point. They really want you running that on its own device and not just alongside a bunch of other stuff.
Well, and it comes in a nice little box. You can run other stuff underneath it, like with the community store. Like you can put a dot, you can just run Docker stuff on it if you want.
Okay.
So
interesting. I'll think about that in the future.
Yeah. And like you can get a CM4 with 16 gigs of RAM or something ridiculous at this point, or 8 gigs of RAM. So Like it runs really nicely on the 2 gig version that I literally just bought the first one I could find about four months ago. And it's a 16 gig storage with 2 gigs of RAM and no Wi-Fi. So it works pretty well. And the PoE is worth the price of admission.
PoE is cool.
PoE, like
power over Ethernet, I guess we should say.
Yeah. I have all of my switches that aren't the one in the garage or the hall closet running off of PoE now, which is like the one in the entertainment center is all just an Ethernet plug going into it. It's real cool.
It's kind of magical, actually.
Yeah.
Just plug a network cable in and nothing else and make the thing go.
Yep. Ralph asks, is it finally time to upgrade to Windows 11? If I recall correctly, Brad, always the cautionary, was still on Windows 10. I too am of the mindset, don't fix what ain't broke, but surely sooner or later it will be time to upgrade. Windows keeps prompting me and I feel somewhat guilty every time I reject the free upgrade. Surely by now a lot of the early adopter flaws must have been ironed out. Have you upgraded? Are you considering it? Best wishes, Ralph.
I am still on Windows 10. I actually like the main reason is that I don't have a TPM in this 7-year-old motherboard.
So you like you'd have switched now if you had the new hardware.
Most likely, yeah. Okay. Like I can't, like it flat out says on the upgrade in the Windows settings, it just says this PC is not eligible for Windows 11. So I just have not. This thing is too old. I'm not going to go out and get a TPM because I am very close to wheels are in motion. Ooh. Let's say wheels are turning on a new PC. I'm hoping in the next, say, 6 to 8 weeks, ooh, it will be done.
Is the new,
it will be done.
You're going to do Windows 11 on the new PC though, right?
Probably. The only thing is, man, this is a bit of a rabbit hole. I've a kind user on the Discord hooked me up with, it is Windows 10 for workstations, I believe is the name of it.
Okay.
Are you familiar with this? Yeah, no. Windows 10 Pro for workstations. It's like a second tier of Pro that has a bunch of like advanced networking. It has ReFS in it, which is their, ooh, Microsoft's like advanced next gen file system. But it's got a bunch of advanced networking stuff in it. Including RDMA Direct, I believe it's called. SMB Direct.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is like a super fast, low CPU usage version of SMB.
That seems like the kind of thing you'd put on all of your all of your clients, but what do I know?
Yeah. So like you need that tier of Windows. I want to see if that key will maybe translate to the Windows 11 version of that before I commit, but like whatever, I'm rambling here. That would be a faster way to like network file shares with my NAS and stuff, but generally, all things being equal, like I think it's probably time to go to Windows 11. When I build that new machine, I most likely will find a way to go to 11 rather than installing that version of 10.
I have been running 11 now for a long time. When I built the new machine last year, I did went 11, and it's been like pretty flawless. I haven't, the only real complaint I have is the new redesigned task manager is feels heavier than it should be.
The task manager feels like the one part, like, okay, I know I and a lot of other people have complained a lot about the weird kind of anachronistic quality of modern Windows, you know, because there are dialogues in there going back to probably 98 still.
Yeah.
You know, like the old control panel is still there, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's a huge pain in the ass. But I feel like task manager is the one exception to that rule where it should never change. Like, it should always just be old reliable task manager. So if they have made it less reliable or slower or whatever, they have messed up.
Well, so the new one has some stuff in there that's nice, and you can actually see like GPU usage now, which was kind of opaque before. So like, it tells you whether you're using the video encode or decode sections of the GPU, whether you're using like the GPU, the 3D portion of the GPU, all that stuff. And it shows you the throughput in and out of the GPU, which is one of the things that's like the most common bottlenecks. But yeah, it doesn't feel as slow on this machine as it did on the 9900K. So it could have just been that I was under spec'd for what Windows 11 wants with a 9900K.
For 9900K, it's not enough for Windows 11. There might be a problem.
Yeah. But, yeah.
You know, I probably have to be on Windows 11 because I'm most likely, well, I can't say for sure, but there's a decent chance I'm going to end up with a CPU that almost certainly will need Windows 11 to work properly.
I mean, that's the thing. It seems like if you're doing what 11th gen Intel or 5000 series or newer.
So it's 12th and 13th gen. It's Alder Lake and Raptor Lake on the Intel side, or the first with the mixed cores that Windows 10 doesn't quite know what to do with.
The bigs and littles.
The regular 7000 Ryzens, I think, are fine because they're all the same core. But then these 3D. Did you keep up with the X3D stuff out of CES? That stuff's weird. I am looking forward to speaking with some people who are knowledgeable about such things in the near future about those things. It's weird because the 3D parts are the ones that have the 3D vertically stacked cache, yeah. L3 cache, that they did the 5800X version of.
Uh-huh.
So they've rolled those out for the 7000 series, but it's that stacked cache is not across all the core complexes, all the CCDs.
Oh, so it's only for certain cores? Big and little on AMD now.
So it's weird. The cores themselves are the same, but the amount of cache they have is different. So it's going to be this weird situation of like some games run better on the cores that have more cache. Some games run better on the other ones because the ones with less cache are probably going to be clocked at a higher frequency. So it's going to be this weird situation like, I don't know. I saw a friend of the show, Gordon, on Twitter, seemed maybe a little skeptical about the ability of either the CPU or Windows or both to intelligently know, like, which cores should this game run on? Which cores should this other one run on?
Well, I mean, that seems like it seems like they've added another axis for scheduling that's going to be challenging.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so I don't know. I'm torn. I'm not sure what I'm going to get, but there's a lot of options now, so I'm going to get something soon.
Well, that's it for questions. Right. Techpod at content.town is the email address. You can send them there. We love to get them. So thanks everybody for sending in this week.
Yeah. All right. How about we move on to the Discord questions?
I love a Discord question.
Ray in reverse. Is console versus PC fair in multiplayer gaming now that games like Call of Duty have them playing on the same server?
Man, I don't know. I get owned by people on Xbox and Switch all the time playing Fortnite.
Really?
I mean, not all the time, but like, it's not like it's an immediate win like it used to be.
Fascinating. That's especially fascinating because, I mean, Xbox obviously is controller, but I bet a large portion of the Fortnite, I mean, the Switch players are probably using gyro aiming, wouldn't you say?
So Switch and PS4 probably are both using gyro.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Or PS5. You can do gyro on both.
Right. But that's yet another factor that's another variable in the mix, right? There's probably like three fairly popular control schemes going on now.
Yeah, the gyro aim, like that, when we launched Santa Cruces, that was the first big request we got was, hey, you got to put gyro aim in. I didn't even occur to me that that was a thing.
Yeah, it's been like a slow realization for me just seeing people talk about it and realizing that like, oh, there are people who are like very hardcore about this specific control scheme and seem very good with it. It's, like, especially if you play like Splatoon 3 or whatever.
It seems specifically gyro good. And flick stick. Yeah. is the thing people like. So
and like I kind of, you know, I get it. Like in some ways the gyro aiming I think probably mirrors the capabilities of a mouse more than a stick does.
Well, yeah, it's a finer control based on the versus the number of inputs that most analog sticks have. Right. I mean, I think you could probably make an analog stick that has the number of like has the precision of a mouse, but I don't know that anybody actually puts those in mass market controllers.
Yeah, the other difference there for me though is that sticks have a neutral position and mice and gyro don't, and sticks also have resistance. So when you let off of them, they return to neutral. So you're fighting a tension there that you're not with those others.
Yeah, I tried to learn gyro controls a couple of years ago, and I find it like I'm better with a gamepad. I'm best with a mouse and keyboard, but like. I mean, I played Call of Duty with friends who play gamepad on a mouse on a PC even, and they're like I feel like the big vendors have gotten good at doing the assist stuff that they need to do to get the controllers to be comparable to mouse and keyboard players.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like I was getting pretty good with the gyro stuff when I played Splatoon for a few weeks.
Yeah,
it's something you can adapt to it for sure.
Splatoon. I have a hard time because I usually play Splatoon not on the TV. I play it on the handheld. It's weird. I've also using the Steam Deck. I've done a lot of gyro stuff because the Steam Deck, like if you're playing a first person shooter on the Steam Deck, the gyro is the way to control that thing if it supports it. So
does Fortnite throw mobile players in the same hopper?
I don't think so by default. I think you can. I think if you're a mobile player, you can play with a friend in one of the main hoppers.
Okay.
But right now, the main hopper in Fortnite, I often see PS4, Switch, and Xbox players. Maybe it's just PS4 and Xbox player, or PS5 and Xbox players, and maybe the Switch players I only see when I play with my daughter. Actually, when I think about it.
Okay, that's fascinating. If you can opt in as a mobile player to other matches, like the idea that there are four different aiming schemes at work in the same match is really kind of cool.
Yeah, I think the other benefit of the gamepads now is that like the analog triggers, depending on what your game uses them for, can kind of be a pro. Like if they give you finer control over steering and gas and stuff in a car. Also, analog movement is really nice. Like you don't have to deal with you don't have a hard modifier for crouch or whatever. You can just push the stick a little bit and walk slower and quieter.
Yes.
So
that is definitely an advantage there.
Yeah.
Let's see. All right. Authentic Sporks. What are your favorite sci-fi robots? Do you swing more function over form? For example, R2-D2 or humanoid like C-3PO. Also, should they speak like us or in random machine noises? I've been watching a lot of Star Wars.
Man, I like that. I like the robots from the Black Hole. The Slim Pickens robot is real good.
is that voiced by Slim Pickens or modeled after Slim Pickens?
It's voiced by Slim Pickens, I believe. And it's like a trash can robot like R2-D2.
Oh, wow. That is a serious trash can.
Have you seen it? It's painted on.
Looking at it with the eyeballs on this thing. Have I seen The Black Hole?
You should watch The Black Hole if you haven't seen it. It's pretty exceptional.
We have this other podcast where we watch a lot of movies. Maybe I should throw that on the list.
Maybe
we should do it on this podcast.
Look, if you're going to do that on that podcast, I would like a guest spot because I want to come talk about the fucking Black Hole. It is a weird ass movie.
Okay, I will put your name down next to that for sure. My stock answer for this question, I apologize if I've given this before, are Case and Tars from Interstellar.
Oh, they're like, that's those the are, real answer to the question. I think
those are all time imaginative and it's entirely possible that they lifted that concept from some other science fiction.
They lifted it from DARPA.
Oh, wait, is that sort of thing like actually in development?
The rotating spiral design was a DARPA design that never went anywhere, I think, or that we know of.
It's funny because in the movie they are surplus Marine Corps robots. So they, even in the fiction, they straight up came out of the American military. But if you haven't seen those robots, they are just rectangles. They are just slabs of like a rectangular slab of metal.
Yeah.
With a ton of points of articulation in there. So they can kind of like dynamically transform themselves into whatever shape they need to be. And I think that the way they get around really fast is to turn themselves into kind of a wheel and just roll.
Yeah, so they can kind of shuffle like just by moving two prongs like legs, but then they can turn into it like an asterisk and basically roll. And it's a pretty neat design.
it's also just an amazing like sort of science fiction plot device, because you can kind of have them turn into any shape that you can think of that serves the needs of the characters at the moment.
Also, like, just the BB-8 design and the way that they did that robot in the Star Wars postquels was accepted. Like it's a cool friggin' robot.
The toys of that thing were a real eye-opening moment for me, because like you see it in the movie and you're like, oh, that's a special effect, like that, wow, you know, of course that looks good because it's in a very big budget movie. But then I saw toys that basically are the exact same thing in real life and I was like, holy shit, mm-hmm. like toy technology, or just like locomotion technology, whatever you want to call it, automatic navigation, like all the things that thing does, like that stuff has gotten amazingly good very quickly.
The Sphero one that they made that was like the hamster ball, because we had some of those hamster ball robots around the whiskey basement back in the day.
Okay.
Chloe famously liked to chase one of them. But they just put the head on top and painted it BB-8 colors, and it is a cool toy. They made practical ones of the BB-8 too for the movies as well. Like they were rolling around set. That was people would visit the set and be like, I can't, how does this work? This is what? Yeah. Anyway, robots are cool, man.
Yeah, they're cool. Okay. Question from, is it Y-Cross? Have we decided?
Y-Cross is a regular in my stream. So I've been Y-Cross for a long time.
Is that the way?
I have not been corrected.
Yes. I also have never been corrected. So I'm going to assume that's fine. Is .chd pronounced CHD or Chud?
I've always said CHD, but now I'm going to say Chud.
Oh no. Oh no. I don't need a Chud file in my life. Hang on. Were you acquainted with .chd before like the last year or two? Cause I only became aware of it in the context of the Mister and people. I don't know if it's a generalized compression format or if it's specifically for image files. I assume the latter. I think it has to be, but it's basically a compressed way to store like a BenQ or an ISO type disk image.
Yeah,
people use it for their libraries. Okay, yeah,
it's only for archiving PlayStation discs, it seems like, or optical discs for game preservation.
Yeah, because I see people using it for like Sega CD and PC Engine CD libraries and stuff as well. But yeah, it's basically just a way to compress your disk images for stuff like that.
I feel like I was exposed to them at some point in the past when like ripping PlayStation 1 and Sega CD and Saturn discs was a thing. I was reading this question last night, I looked it up and I was like, man, I have enormous gaps in like Sega CD and PlayStation, because I didn't have PlayStation came out when I was in college and didn't have any money, and I bought an N64, which like I wanted to play the Nintendo games. I don't regret that choice,
as one does.
Yeah. But it also means that by the time I was like working in the industry and was working Maximum PC, like I bought a PS2 and I played a bunch of I went through the PS2 bangers. Right. But I never went back to play the PS1 games. So like, I have no idea what is cool or why on the PlayStation 1. And I feel like I need to go back and explore that gap.
That's a big question. That thing was so popular. There are thousands of games for it. It's especially now that we've got things like the Mister, or, you know, emulators are also very good, and you kind of are tempted to store an entire library of those things.
Yeah.
The PlayStation makes that difficult, because I'm sitting here tallying right now. The PC Engine is still counting up. I can tell you a full Sega CD set, like every game ever released for the Sega CD, is 124 gig.
The PlayStation one's probably 3 terabytes, right?
Yeah, that's what mine is showing. The TurboGrafx CD or PC Engine CD is 214 gigabytes. So those are like reasonable if you've got a decent size storage volume. I'm like, okay, sure, I'll have every game released for those CD systems, but the PlayStation is terabytes.
And it
definitely gets into like, do I really need every PlayStation game ever released? Some of those are pretty bad.
Well, and also like, I don't know, like it's hard enough, like it's enough pre the modern internet that like there's not even like, there's like IGN lists of the top 100 PS1 games or whatever, but that doesn't give me the context of those games when they I kind of want to know the context of those games when they came out. Right. Like I want to know why people were excited about Chrono Cross or whatever. And I mean, I know why they were excited about Chrono Cross, but like, the context around those games is as important for games that age as the games themselves, I think, now. So anyway.
Yeah.
Chud, that's the answer. Yeah.
Before we move on in the context of .chud files, I know this is juvenile. I became aware of the existence of a .ass file over the weekend.
What do you use the .ass file for? It's,
what do you want to use it for?
Well, I mean,
it's a subtitle format, apparently.
Really?
Like a very cool subtitle format. Actually, I had no idea what it was until I looked into it. But look, I dabbled with a little bit of anime. OK, some out of print old anime.
Oh, boy.
I was just reliving my high school
anime editor. TechPod anime editor Brad Shoemaker at it again.
That's me. I don't know if it's still in wide use, but people in Discord were saying apparently .ass, like the ass format for subtitles. I can't help it. It's funny.
So here's my question.
The ass file, I don't know if it's still as popular as it used to be. Real quick, I'll just tell you what it is. So you can store custom fonts.
Oh, so you can properly display papyrus with Avatar using an ass.
Yes, exactly.
Nice.
Oh, God, I didn't even think about that. It's interesting, though, like if you FF probe an MKV that has ass subtitles
don't
in it.
Don't probe your ass file, Brad. It's not a good idea.
Is that the title of the show?
Look,
permissible.
I mean, we can put ass as long as you put the dot before ass so people know we're talking about the file format and not something untoward.
I've written this down. I'm going to stare at it and think about it a little bit.
Yeah, think about what you've done.
It's cool, though. So if you FF probe the file, it'll just literally say like stream number 4 is a TrueType font file. Like you can literally just embed standard font files in the container.
Oh, that's cool.
And they also can store positional data. So you can, subtitles don't just default to the bottom of the screen. You can put them anywhere on the screen. So you can like put subtitles like right next to a signage or something in the frame and with custom fonts and stuff. It's super neat. But that also led me to, I don't know if it was proprietary originally, but now there is an open source library, which of course is called libass.
Of course.
That lets you work with.
Does that predate the Blu-ray font subtitle format, which also has some similar features?
I don't know. The little bit I looked around at the .ass stuff seemed like it came into being maybe around 07, 08, which is right when Blu-ray took off.
That would maybe as a response, a necessity to the Blu-ray. Because I can't remember. I think it's a Guy Ritchie movie or something that the subtitles are placed underneath the people who are talking, and each character has like a unique twist on the font or a different font treatment.
Huh.
And I feel like that was one of the showcases for shit you can do on Blu-ray that you couldn't do on DVD.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm glad I learned about the ass file, Brad.
I can't not laugh at it. I know it's dumb. Everybody else got over this 10 years ago at least, but
yeah.
Let's see. A question from Pat Bear, friend of the show.
Hey, Pat.
When you're installing new software, why do they call it a wizard?
Oh, man. So I went and looked this up to make sure that I got this right.
Is there an answer? I didn't know.
Yeah, there is an answer. So, here's the thing that people don't remember in the 21st century. Installing software used to be hard. Like even on Windows, in the Windows 3.1 days, when you got like a copy of Photoshop or something, you had to install it. It would have a folder in the thing on the disk or on the a supplements floppy disk sometimes that would have all of the stuff that Photoshop depended on that you had to install too. If you didn't install that stuff, Photoshop wouldn't work right. So what important technology cultural thing. In the olden days of computers, before everybody got phones and laptops and all that stuff, nerds called the people who were the real nerds wizards. Like people would sign their Usenet posts software wizard or Emacs wizard or whatever.
Okay.
So when the first company built an installer package that would install all of the, you could give it a list of all the stuff that needed to be installed, package it on the disk with it, and it would install all of the Visual C++ libraries and all that stuff in the appropriate places. They called it a wizard, mimicking the people, the people who self-identified as wizards. And like, there's even facts about what a wizard is in terms of computer use, where somebody who's kindly and helpful and generous with their time, and Gandalf's not Radagast the Brown or anything like that. Anyway,
Radagast is all right.
Look, he just likes the animals more than the people. That's fine. I can respect that.
I feel like those movies did him a little disservice.
His red velvet pancake puppies were the bomb, though. That's what I will say.
Fair.
They called it a wizard. It's funny. We talk about this on the episode of the Foss Pod that I think will be out next week, because we talk about Debian a lot, as we have one of the Debian maintainers on.
Yeah. And project leader.
Yeah. And it was a fascinating conversation to think, because now it's hard to remember a time when installing software was a challenge. But it used to be that even on Windows, like installing software on Linux prior to apt and PKG, DPKG, DPKG was hard. Installing software on Windows prior to Windows 95, kind of, you could mess it up. You could have problems. So, yeah,
that's weird. I'd completely forgot about that stuff. It's almost like you're installing dependencies for your Windows application that point.
Yeah, you very much were. Because depending on which compiler people use to make the Windows software, like you'd have to install a Borland C library or whatever. And now we just don't need that stuff. Just happens in the background automatically. So we don't even think about it.
Yeah. Next question, which I had and then immediately scrolled away from.
Oh, idle scrolling screws us again.
That's a bad thing to do. Oh boy. Can you fill for a moment?
Yeah. Do you want me to pick one? I got a quick one.
Okay, go for it.
MSC says, do you still feel that Linux is only free if you value your time at zero?
I was going to take this one to you later. That one is an interesting question to me.
Like that was the joke for a long time, just to be clear. I think some people thought it was a joke. I think the Windows people that posted on forum probably didn't think it was a joke.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've felt that way for a pretty long time. Like Linux is a profoundly useful piece of software.
For sure. Also, I mean, that came about back in the day because software back then was very expensive, right? Like,
yeah,
you kind of don't have to pay for Windows now. Like they basically give it away.
Well,
but back then, like a Windows license was expensive. Like Visual C++ was expensive, you know?
Yeah.
Like we talked about that on the Blender Foss Pod, you know, back when Blender started, a C++ compiler cost hundreds of dollars. Right. And so like, Linux wasn't just a free operating system. It was also free development tools, you know, so it was actually a big deal that you could get a full suite of, you know, tools to make software with without paying anything.
Or Windows even.
Yeah.
Right. Like the thing though, also it was that became popular in the time when people were trying to run Linux on the desktop as an alternative to Windows. In a less constrained way than most people who run Linux on the desktop do. Yeah. Like I think most people who are running Linux on the desktop now are probably running Chromebooks and Chromeboxes and stuff like that. Right. They're not running Debian stable on their desktop. I don't think that's been, I mean, look, I have two or three Linux boxes in the house, depending on whether you count like Raspbian installs as Linux boxes. They're incredibly useful and I would value them that much greater than zero, given the stuff that they do for me.
Yes. I think the one place that still kind of holds true is when you just have a goal in mind, a project, you're trying to get some service running, Home Assistant or Plex or blah, 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 you know, and you get mired in like, we need a term for this, like the kind of Google hell of like Googling error messages and various terminology that you don't understand. And like you spend days trying to understand why something isn't working. Like that's still the one place where it feels like, oh man, okay, I don't know if this is actually a great use of my time. But like the place where Linux feels super valuable for me is just learning about it. You know, it's like when I'm not being frustrated by it, but instead I am filled with wonder at all the stuff you can do. Like that's where it feels like truly valuable.
Well, and it's interesting because like those places that you get mired, like I just went through that with the Plex install. I think I talked about it in the episode last week a little bit, but like the entirety of that problem could have been bypassed if Intel's driver installation was clearer about what version of the kernel it needed to have in order to work right. Right. Like if it had said, hey, you need this version of the kernel or newer in order for this to work, it would have been a 30-minute project for me and I would have been up and running in no time. So thanks, Intel.
You know what? I
guess I could submit a note and patch their patch notes, but
dude, it feels good to stay tuned for the shocking reveal in the Foss Pod about
Brad's new gig.
About filing bugs and et cetera with open source projects. Anyway, next week.
Yeah.
You know what? I screwed myself with this new methodology.
Oh, no.
I scrolled right past the yellow highlighted questions.
Oh, yeah, they're invisible.
My brain was only looking at the bolded questions, and since I flagged this one in yellow, I completely bypassed it. But this is the one I was looking for from Slam Donk.
It's a good name. It's a good name.
What do you think will become of the knowledge shared and dispersed across forums and other persistent searchable communities as more of these small communities move to more ephemeral, less queryable locations like Discord? Will the web forum always have a place, or do you think we risk losing some tribal knowledge as they fall out of vogue? I think that is definitely a risk. What was it? Oh, it was Twitter. God, it was Twitter. I mean, Twitter is a more recent example than internet forums, but like when Musk took over and the future of the platform looked very much in doubt, and I guess it still is, but the number of like journalists and historians that were coming out of the woodwork going like, holy shit, if this all goes away, like there is a massive amount of the last like 15 years of culture documented on this platform.
Yeah.
You know, Arab Spring organizing and all kinds of stuff, investigative reporting.
The blue dress, like gold dress day.
Yeah, sure. The most important,
the most important stuff.
But even like, you know, like documentary video evidence of war crimes and stuff, you know, like some serious stuff is contained in this platform that everybody just assumed would persist forever. And all of a sudden it seems, you know, at risk of maybe going away, and that would be a massive loss. I mean, granted, there's a lot of important stuff on the Something Awful forums, but maybe nothing that quite rises to that level, although there was some investigative reporting that came out of there. But like even then, you know, like even early internet stuff contained on like fan communities and forums and stuff like that, like that's all culture that is valuable. And, you know, well, the Wayback Machine can only do so much, I feel like.
To me, it used to be that like the good, if you had a technological problem too, the good way to solve that problem was to type the problem you had and then put message board or forum at the end of it, right? And you'd get a thread on you know, Stack Exchange or some relevant forum that would give you a good kicking off point to find the solve for your problem. I think the thing to me that stood out about this question is that the general degradation of search quality over the last couple of years is the larger problem, right? Like we're already seeing, even pre chat GPT and all that stuff, we're seeing a dramatic degradation in the quality of search results. Cause you get those page when you search for something, you get like the, if you search for lollipop creation, then you get a page that's like, what is it most important about lollipop creation? Well, lollipop creation starts at the candy factory. Candy factories are a place where blah, 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 blah. And they're just nonsense pages that are completely devoid of valuable information.
Yep.
And like when I've explored, like, I posted a tomato soup recipe on shitty.blog a few weeks ago. Ooh. And somebody was like, you should check out, it's a real good tomato soup recipe. But somebody was like, hey, I only read recipes if there's like a really long heartfelt story about the origin of the recipe and like how you were ostracized as a child for liking that particular food and how you turned around people's lives by changing that. So I was like, okay. And I went and typed that prompt into ChatGPT and then pasted it onto the blog post. And now there's like four paragraphs of garbage text that fit the format of recipe blog, heartfelt story with stunning revelations and like a little bit about the politics of tomatoes and like it's we're hosed. Like, it's a real problem.
Yeah, seriously, man. Should I actually, maybe I'll just move on to the next. I have a related question here. I'm trying to find it.
I think Google's going to give up the search. I think we've had 20 years of a time when search was useful, and I'm worried that it's good that time has passed.
Yeah, for sure. Also, I mean, if I could be a little like inward looking for a minute, I mean, you know, I have been through the experience once, and it wasn't a complete experience, but it's pretty close, of like work I did just vanishing from the internet.
Yeah.
On GameSpot. Like,
yeah,
all the reviews I wrote are still there and et cetera, but a lot of the custom built feature content on that site is just gone. And you can find some of it on the Wayback Machine, and some of it's like slightly broken on there, but like watching years of your life just kind of vanish, years of your kind of professional output, is rough.
I made a magazine that people read on the toilet and then threw it in the recycling bin every month.
Fair, I guess. No, maybe it's not a unique experience, I guess, but archiving that stuff is a topic of concern for me. I lack the web design prowess to use the right words here, but like the way web pages are put together these days, you can't just save as a web page and get a static page that works.
Yeah.
Like all dynamic units and blah, blah, blah. Like, again, I can't quite articulate what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like, it's tough. It's tough to go archive stuff that is like served in the way that web pages are served now. And so I've been talking to some people on the Discord about like backing up like my Giant Bomb profile and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting, it's a real problem.
Yeah.
Like that archival. I mean, we should get somebody from Internet Archive on to talk about this, because it's an interesting challenge, and they have,
oh yeah,
they have a really good approach to that now, I think.
Are they? They are in the city, right? They're here. They're
mostly East Bay, I think. Jason's got an acquaintance. He has agreed to be on the podcast in the past, and then the pandemic happened, and we stopped recording in person, and I haven't followed back up with him.
So
I don't know if we should put this in the show.
I think it's probably fine.
Okay.
I'm looking. There's a building near here that I think might be.
Well, maybe it's
not their whole operation, but I'm looking up. Okay, that is absolutely it. There is a,
yeah.
I live walking. It's a building with columns.
Yep.
And like stately kind of presentation that I have walked by numerous times. I think I might have seen a sign. Maybe that's what tipped me off. But yeah, I thought that was their building.
Yeah,
probably not their server farm,
I believe.
Yeah, that's probably not their data center, but I think that might be their headquarters. We should do that. That would be fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of AI and stuff, question from Warbird. What is the over-under that Apple is using AI-powered chatbots to field level 1 tech support questions? I just had an interaction that I frankly wouldn't be surprised was automated in nature, but was of a better quality than what you usually see for chatbots. Yes, I know that isn't how over-under works. No, I do not care. I think we've lost the battle on over-under.
I don't know how over... I don't know that I ever knew how over-under works.
It's a gambling thing. It's a gambling framework.
Yeah.
The house picks a... I don't know what the term is.
The house picks a base number. So you say
number.
Like if it's a football game, you say like 70 points combined.
Something like, yeah, like they'll pick a specific outcome and then you bet on the over or the under. You bet that it's going to be higher than that or lower than
that. What if it's exactly that? You lose?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't like gambling.
I blame Ryan because he's the first person I ever heard using that term. I'm pretty sure he knew how it worked, but.
Yeah, he would have known how it worked.
It caught, yeah. But yes, I went to horse races with him. I'm pretty sure he knew how it worked, but. It seems to have just become a stand-in for what are the odds, which I know that I am half the people listening to this podcast are rolling their eyes right now because who cares, right?
I think it's pretty likely that everybody, if they aren't using it already, so it's a math problem, right? The answer to this question is a math problem. Is it cheaper to pay somebody in an inexpensive developing country to sit on a keyboard typing stuff into the keyboard to answer questions, or is it cheaper to use the energy required to generate high quality chat interactions using an AI chat algorithm? Probably it's cheaper to use the computer, would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's a really dark time coming if we're not careful, where we kill off a lot of the low skill jobs. And then increasingly high skill jobs without having a way for people to support themselves. That's going to end up in a real like grim Ready Player One kind of like, I think like, look, here's the bummer. This is the bummer theme of the episode. What if the thing that Ready Player One got right isn't the stupid metaverse, which they kind of, with all the everybody's favorite pop culture references from the 80s, but the stacks of mobile homes piled up on top of each other, which is where people actually live in the real world, because that's all anybody can afford.
Man. Yeah, I would, not to be a downer, I think I would remove the qualifier you just gave of if we're not careful, we're going to end up in a dark time. I think it's just a flat. We're going to end up in a dark time.
Well, I'm a little more of an optimist than you, Brad.
Well, the bellwether for me is, this feels like it just came out of nowhere, basically since New Year's. degree to which you are seeing the investor and management classes now talking excitedly about replacing jobs with AI is very alarming to me, because like when the people with all the money get really excited about it is when it starts getting dangerous.
Well, that's true.
That it's going to become actualized and not just theoretical.
What if now here's a thought. What if we replace all the hedge fund managers with AI?
Now you're talking.
Yeah.
I mean, that's entirely possible. Like, it is very possible that AI could do a better job of managing investments like that than a human being.
Well, the problem is the people will just pay the machines. We'll pay for the machines and use those as tools rather than replace themselves with them, because they're the money people.
Yeah, sure. Fair. Yeah. Somehow they always find a way to remain on top.
Well, look, they're first against the wall when the revolution comes, Brad.
Oh, man. It's going to be a whole thing. All right. Another question. Another Warbird question.
Oh, no.
Congratulations to Warbird on the twofer. Neither of them are about college football. Oh, no. What is the over under on Apple eventually integrating AirTag functionality into all of their portable hardware? One of my favorite AirPod Pros, I think. This is little case pro, because there is an AirPod Pro product,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think what he's saying is one of my favorite pros of the AirPods.
Yes.
Is the ability to ping the case. Same goes for the watch and phone combo. To have the ability to point my phone around and figure out where the hell the baby put the damn iPad would be amazing. To be clear, I mean more the 3D space tracking deal you can do with newer phones, not just the find my stuff. Again, yes, I know about over under. No, I do not care.
I like the most obvious place that they could do this is the remote for the Apple TV.
Okay.
Because if you have a kid, that remote, God only knows where it is. It's probably in a peanut butter jelly sandwich someplace, covered in like gooed up and covered in jelly. I mean, my kid's pretty tidy at this point, but the point remains. Like I've the number of hours I've spent looking for an Apple TV remote over the last year and a half, 10 years is enormous. And I literally waited the last time I bought a new Apple TV for the living room a couple of years ago, and I was waiting until they announced the 4K, the not the latest 4K ones, but the second to latest 4K ones, to see if they put an AirTag in the remote, and they did not, and I was sad.
I have to assume, I mean, the AirTags are so small, I have to assume that a technical limitation would not prevent them from doing what he's suggesting. It would just be a business limitation, right? Of, hey, we have this whole product line for these things, and we don't want to cannibalize that by just putting it in all our other products.
I would replace every remote in the house if they sold remotes. If I could buy extra remotes that have the AirTag built in, I would replace every single remote I own with those.
Yeah. So I mean, the AirTag's fine. Like, I just didn't really have a use case for it. Like, I was not personally interested in it until this past holiday when all the air travel chaos happened.
Yeah.
And I became aware of this phenomenon of people putting AirTags in their suitcases when they travel.
Lufthansa prohibits that.
Oh, no.
You're not allowed to do that.
Wait, just by policy, or do they have a technical means of blocking it?
No, they say you're not allowed to do that.
Oh, I see. Well,
I think their reason is because they don't want you to know where your luggage is.
I was going to say, try and stop us cops, airplane cops. I followed a couple of Twitter threads over the holidays. It was just interesting to watch this play out of people whose luggage got lost in, I think, mostly the Southwest kerfuffle.
Yeah.
Who were extremely intensively tracking the location of their suitcase as it moved around in real time.
Well, the neat thing about it is the AirTags work by using everybody that has an iPhone's Bluetooth. So if you're in range of somebody who has an iPhone, which is like 40% of the world's population that has smartphones at this point, you can tell where your stuff is. Google apparently has one of these things coming too.
Is that something you can opt out of as an iPhone user?
That is a very good question, Brad.
Huh. Interesting. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I don't think I would opt out if that was an option. I'm just curious because it does seem like that maybe something they should offer.
They hash the information that comes out so that when you bump the information back to the network, it doesn't include any personally identifiable information for the person who's doing the narking. So I don't think it's an issue.
Yeah, I believe that. It's more just that they're using your data, you know, like, I mean, I'm sure it is kilobytes of data. I'm sure it is not a big deal, but like adding any amount of network traffic to your device that you didn't ask for is maybe a little questionable.
Well, the interesting thing I wonder is if they're going to make like the baggage handlers put their phones in a locker or something before they go out and are working around the bags.
Yeah.
For the company. Yeah.
I didn't see how it resolved. There was one Twitter thread that went viral over the holidays of a lady who, what airline was it? I guess I shouldn't put any of them on blast, but she had been tracking her bag, and the location of the bag was extremely not what the airline was telling her it was. It was at somebody's apartment.
Oh, whoops.
And she tracked it like she tracked it making a trip to McDonald's one day. Oh. I didn't see how it resolved. I'm guessing what it is that they were using like third party contractors for kind of the bag, I don't know, retrieval or storage or delivery or whatever. And this person, kind of in the same way that, you know, like Comcast will send a third party, like a contracted installer to your house, not a Comcast employee. I assume it was something like that. I don't know. I assume she got her bag eventually, but the airline support was being kind of shitty to her. Like she posted a screenshot of the chat with the rep, quite literally said, "Calm down. Your bag is fine," at one point, which, like, even if that's the case, probably not the best thing to say to a customer in the age of social media.
Look, my policy is you never check anything that's worth more than $600 combined. And you assume that it's gone the moment you put it on the belt.
Yeah, I just as a matter of policy, do everything I can not to check bags these days. Like I just try to travel as light as possible so I don't have to worry about stuff like this. But anyway, it was just an interesting thing to see play out in the context of like what modern consumer tech is empowering people to do that they couldn't do before, such as see exactly where their lost luggage is. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
How about, I'm just trying to decide when to move into the big cake batter finish here.
I'm going to do like two more regular. We had such a bounty. We might have to do a patron Q&A episode this month because they're real good.
Yeah, we have been getting a ton. I know we keep saying this, but like we seriously get. This could almost be an all question show. I think at this point we get so many good ones.
Yeah.
Do you want to do this one for MattBot about? Here, I'll just read it. You can answer if you want.
Yeah, I highlighted this one because I had an answer for this.
If you had 100% of all medical expenses covered for a year, what kind of testing or treatments would you get done? I hit my deductible early this year and I'm looking for ideas.
So I literally had that happen last year.
Oh,
because my gallbladder stuff happened in the spring January. And I'm going to go and tell you, I fucked up and didn't get anything done.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's like free. Well, not free. You probably still would have had to pay something, but that's a heavily discounted medical care.
I got distracted and I didn't get anything booked. And by the time I realized I'd messed up, it was too late. So,
man, I know we complain about health insurance a lot. I guess I apologize, although it is extremely lamentable.
It sucks.
Deplorable is a better word. But like, I'm sure people in other countries are just like having their heads spin when they hear conversations like this, that yes, if you hit your deductible early in the year, you want to try to cram more medical stuff in while it's cheap, because at the beginning of the next year, that whole thing resets and then you have to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket again. That happened to me. That happened to me with the vocal cord issue stuff. I had some speech therapy that was not covered by my insurance until I paid a lot of money for it. And the therapist had scheduled all of my appointments through the end of the year so that roughly half of them were going to be covered. Again, I had to pay the whole cost out of pocket, which was hundreds of dollars per appointment until insurance, I think, kicked in 80% after that.
Yeah.
And literally after the last appointment that I had to pay full price on before the insurance would kick in, I never found out what happened, but the therapist had to cancel the rest of our appointments for the year and wanted to reschedule them for the new year.
And it was just like, no.
Cool. Now I get to pay full price for the rest of these as well. Like, just due to a shitty calendar technicality. That's the American healthcare system.
I've been scheming with my GP to figure out, don't tell anybody, this is all off the record, right? To figure out how to get like the full body MRI so we have a baseline.
Oh, interesting. Is that a preventative thing that people do now?
Well, so you can pay to have it done. It's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
I also am not sure I can do an MRI. Like, I feel like I might, I don't generally get claustrophobic, but maybe, I don't know. It's pretty small in there. Anyway, I feel like that's probably the thing I would, if I was going to do anything, it would be some sort of full body image. So you have a baseline from like whatever age, you know, mid 40s, early 40s, mid 30s, whatever.
I mean, that's another issue. I mean, I can tell you, knowing people who work in the medical field, that is a huge problem of people neglecting preventative care. I mean, that, you know, MRI, like an unsolicited MRI is maybe a little bit, like, that's extremely proactive.
Yeah.
But even more basic preventative stuff, like, people neglect it all the time because they can't afford it or they have to pay too much out of pocket for it. And that leads to all kinds of worse outcomes because people don't catch things early because they weren't getting checked for them. And then by the time you can't ignore the problem anymore, it's a bad situation.
Get your colonoscopies and pap smears and all that stuff, folks. Yeah. Mammograms.
I might line up a hearing test, honestly.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I have some hearing loss. I can't tell if it's hearing loss or a neuro problem.
Yeah.
Because I have trouble picking out voices in crowds.
Interesting. I'm kind of getting there a little bit. I've had like a problem talking over people on these video calls more lately that I can't seem to lick. And I've also got like pretty profound tinnitus in my right ear for the last 4 or 5 months. Like it's high pitched. It sucks. It really sucks.
Do you know about the tapping the back of the bone behind your ear?
No.
Kind of resets the nerves when you have tinnitus.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I think I might wear earbuds too much.
Oh, that would do it.
I really wonder not. I mean, for myself and like as a society, the amount of earbud use seems like it might be precarious.
I feel like there's going to be, I'm just waiting for the, hey, it turns out what we thought were the safe hearing limits were really way dramatically too high for a long time. So I don't know.
Yeah. To be fair, this kind of ringing in the ear can be all kinds of stuff. It can be genetics and age and like all sorts of other factors as well. My ENT kind of just said, get over it, which sounds like a very common experience because there is no real treatment for it. Like the official recommendation is like, you're going to have to find a way to live with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes when you get that response from a doctor, the right answer is to find a better doctor.
Yeah, I guess so.
Depends on how you feel about how they are.
I guess you're right. Okay, quick question from Aaron MT here. I have a personal interest here. How's latency in wireless computer peripherals these days? Are wireless mice and keyboards good enough that it's non-issue? I'm always looking to reduce cords, but I am wary of the time when wireless tech in the early days sucked. How is it now?
I use a Logitech Lightspeed mouse, one of the G3 Pro Superlights. Indistinguishable from a wire.
That's a whole tangent I didn't even intend to get into. I'm pretty close to pulling the trigger on a Lightspeed mouse myself because I want to go cordless. Also, this MX518 is kind of falling apart.
Yeah, that's an old mouse at this point.
Well, this was the reissue. This was the I just bought it a couple of years ago.
Okay,
kind of surprised how quickly started malfunctioning. Anyway, it's pretty much all fine, right? Like I use a Bluetooth keyboard for gaming and I have not noticed any issues with latency.
So the Superlight isn't Bluetooth. I mean, the Logitech stuff has both a 2.4 gigahertz low latency, high refresh, like 1000 hertz refresh cycle connection. The Bluetooth, the difference is that like the amount of battery that's in this mouse gives you like 30 days on Bluetooth or 3 on the Lightspeed.
Oh, interesting.
I for that reason I do the pad. I have the charge pad underneath it.
Oh, but that means you still have a cord.
It's one cord and it comes straight out. I also have a wired keyboard. So I have a mechanical keyboard with lights and I do wired for that just because it's like the battery usage is such.
You're not as obsessive about desk clutter as I am.
No, I am it turns out I have grown to realize that I embrace and enjoy a small amount of desk clutter.
That's fair.
And by that, I mean moderate piles.
That's fair.
My desk would give you hives, Brad.
Oh boy. Let's just not. The tangent I almost got off on here was looking at reviews for different mice. I became aware of the phenomenon of the light mouse.
Oh, the light mouse is real good.
Like there's a whole cult. Yes, it seems a little cultish.
Look, the final mouse people, they're a little crazy.
Is that where it came from? Like there are people out there modding their mice to make them lighter at this point. Like
I've done that. I pulled bits out of my old mouse to make it lighter.
Okay. Yeah. There's like, I don't know if there's a subreddit for it, but I've seen a bunch of Reddit posts when I was Googling about it of people like cutting sections out of the casing. Mm-hmm. Like those mice you see with the honeycomb hole pattern in them.
Yeah.
Are definitely those are trying to reduce weight, but it's people modding their mice with Dremels and stuff at this point to like remove as many materials as they can.
Uh-huh.
So I was just about ready to pull the trigger on a G502X. I think there's a bunch of models. They rolled out a refresh of the G502.
Yeah.
Which I believe is the X, and then the X Plus has RGB. I think that's the distinction. Anyway, the new G502 that just came out like 3 months ago, I was all ready to buy it. And then I looked at the weight and I saw people going like, the only real dock against is it's pretty heavy. And I was like, oh no, is my mouse too heavy? Am I buying too heavy a mouse? Am I screwing up here? I can't decide.
So the thing I will say as a former proponent of the heavy mouse is that landing flick shots in like PUBG and Fortnite and stuff like that, where you move the mouse very quickly and stop on a very high precision point, seems easier with the light mouse.
That's fair. You're also operating at a higher level of play than me.
I don't think it matters if you're not playing pretty competitive games.
Yeah. Okay.
But I used to be the guy who loaded up all the weights in the mouse. And as soon as I stopped doing that, I immediately got better at first person shooters.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Quick. Let's see. Hang on. There are 15 cake batter questions in here.
How many are highlighted? Should we do that lightning round one from Safin?
Oh, gosh. We might have to save that one.
Okay. Okay.
For time here. We'll get back to that. You're right. That's a good one.
Maybe it's real good. Maybe we can do it next month if we don't do it this month.
Or we just tack it on next week or something.
Yeah.
Should we do the
Alberta one?
Yes, that one's. I'll finish with that one.
Okay.
Pickles sliced lengthwise or widthwise?
Always length.
Really?
Sandwiches, everything. I get the long slices and everything.
I guess we're basically talking chips versus strips here.
I like a spear.
Okay, like spears half. Spears are good for eating. They're not so good for sandwiches because they're not flat.
Yeah, no, but I like a sliced long for sandos.
The stacker, I believe the stacker is the term that is used in the marketing mostly now.
That's a brand.
Is it?
It's owned by Clausen, I believe.
Okay.
Vlasic.
Those are the thin lengthwise, like they're basically the thickness of chips, but yeah. Just the whole length of the plant. We only had chips growing up. Pickles were just little chips to me.
Were you sweet and sour?
We mostly had dill around the house.
See, we were all sweet and sour for slices. We were all sweet and sour for eating. We were all dill.
Yes. The dill absolutely was the thing you would just grab out of the fridge and eat.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, like for eating, I'm a whole pickle guy. Give me the whole.
Sure.
The thick boy.
Yeah.
I'm just going to chop that thing. Crack the skin.
I did a fair amount of eating whole pickles myself. You know what else was good?
What?
And perhaps still is a big old jar of whole pepperoncinis.
Oh, I'll look.
Just grab a couple of those. You got to be careful, though, because they hold the liquid. They hold the brine.
Well, if you bite down on those
things wrong, you get a stream of brine shooting everywhere.
A chopped up pepperoncini on top of a sando, though.
Oh, yeah. Nice add. Oh, yeah. Oh,
just like make a little relish there.
It's top tier.
Yeah.
We keep both around, actually. We keep whole pepperoncinis and also like a kind of a diced jar.
I think my first introduction to the pepperoncini as a condiment was when Papa John's came to my hometown.
I think you're right.
And yeah, like pizza. They chucked a couple of those in with the pizza and you're like, what are these weird pepper? Oh man, these are good.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do like one or two more quick ones. Some of these are toe shoes. Why are they controversial?
People are weird about feet, man.
I guess that's true. I don't know. There is a certain.
Look.
Yeah, you know that I started to say there's a certain fashion issue there, but you know what? Those are kind of ridiculous enough to be cool.
They're no different than wearing sandals for all intents and purposes, except for some people get really skeezed out by them. Yeah. I enjoyed when we worked in the basement office and I was riding BART to work every day and I did the video for those and wore them on BART every day. I got a lot of questions about like more than anything else. Like I got more questions about that than like Google Glass or having an early smartphone or anything like that. People would come up and be like, hey, what the hell's the deal with your shoes? And then you'd talk about them and they'd be like, oh, that's interesting. And like, it's like walking barefoot. It's like, yeah, it's like walking barefoot. Now walking barefoot does not seem like a desire. Like that seems like a young man's game. Mm-hmm. Now I want like some heavy arch support. I want a big foamy sole. Uh-huh. I want to not feel the ground under my feet.
Yes. I increasingly am with you. Okay. Is it sacrilegious to put a scoop of ice cream in a glass of stout instead of root beer and have an ice cream beer float?
Have you ever? I've always seen that. I've never tried it.
Is that a thing? Is that something
that's
people
a thing.
Do?
That's like, a thing. Which, you can get that at bars.
I don't know if I'm trying to think what stout you would use. I don't, Guinness is maybe a little too.
It would be like a.
I don't know if
Magnolia used to do that with like with fancy Byright ice. You get a fancy scoop of Byright vanilla ice cream, put it in one of their porters or stouts.
Okay. Yeah, like something that's a little more of a sweeter, like a chocolate stout kind of thing. I could see that working pretty well.
Yeah, you want something that's not like, I don't know. It's just I don't know about that one.
Yeah, I'd try it. It's probably not something I would seek out.
See, I say that I would try it, but I've been presented with lots of opportunities in the past to try it, and I've always been like, I'm probably good with just a beer or just ice cream. I mean, look, I like ice cream too. Sure. Who can say?
All right, last question. How do you feel about the perfect Alberta-shaped hole in the brown rat's natural habitat? And
there's a map.
Literally, this map he provided. The entire world is the brown rat's natural habitat, except for like the extreme Arctic.
Greenland and like northern, like Newfoundland and stuff like that.
And Alberta.
Parts
considerably north of Alberta are valid habitat. Alberta is not. What is going on in Alberta?
So I read the linked Wikipedia article.
Okay.
Apparently, the brown rat cannot overwinter in Alberta without being indoors.
Huh.
And they realized this before there was indoor rat infestations in Alberta.
Okay.
And they went on a massive rat extermination campaign in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Oh, man.
And raising buildings to get rid of rats.
Oh, that's, I don't know how I feel about that. I know that rats are pests for a lot of people for legitimate reasons, but also as the owner or perhaps the servant of rodents.
Yeah.
I feel a little weird about this.
I feel like the pigs have a little more personality. Like, look, I have known rats. I've also worked in labs where we had rats. So okay. I have a different relationship.
Fair.
Probably. Like, I don't feel great about that. Just to be clear.
Yeah.
I don't know. We have a rat, like I can't have bird feeders because of the rats in our backyard, and they're your Norwegian brown rat or whatever.
Fair. I get it.
I'm not a huge fan.
Yeah.
Of the rat. Fine. I know that I'm sure they have personality and all that, but whatever. The Alberta shaped hole. I bet that there's rats in there somewhere, man.
Look, don't believe Alberta's lies.
Yeah, this is all fucking propaganda.
They would like you to believe there are no brown rats in Alberta.
The interesting thing is there's some Saskatchewan shade in that article, too, where they're like, hey, you know, Saskatchewan's trying to get rid of them, but they don't have the fucking moral certitude and chutzpah to exterminate the brown rat.
Alberta just creating its own alternate reality up there.
Do they have black rats there? That's the real question.
I don't know. All right. That's it. That's questions. Yes,
rats.
Thanks to everybody who wrote in. This was a good month of questions. Perhaps we will do some more of these on the Patreon episode.
It was a banner crop. And as always, speaking of Patreon episodes, thank you to our patrons.
Yeah, thank you, patrons.
Thank you, patrons. We appreciate all of you. But since it's the end of the month, we appreciate some of you more than we do other weeks of the month. So thank you first to all of our executive producer tier patrons, including Octothorpe Bunny, where do I put income from crimes on my 1099? It's tax season, I guess. Andrew Slosky, Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil. David Allen, James Kamick, Joel Krauska, Just Wedge, Nick Johnston, and Twinkle Twinkie. Thank you also so much. And then since it's the end of the month, we also thank our associate producer tier patrons, including Alejandra Navarro, Andre M. Burke, Arthur Keys, Dave Ullian, Eric Klein, Graham Banks, Jad Rita, Jason Rooney the Ref, Jay Maybe, Matt Walker, Walkman 8080 in parentheses there, Nathan Phelps, Sanchit Kumar, Steve Lynn, Thomas Shea, Tom Hilton, and Travis Rosner. Thank you also so much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
And if you would like to find out more about the TechPod and how to support it, you can go to patreon.com/techpod. We have had a fascinating conversation about spinning up a ghost for people who are not super keen about Patreon, which I get. The one question that people had asked that didn't get answered in the previous episodes was, why didn't we just do Ghost in the beginning? The answer is we weren't sure if there were network effects on Patreon. And also Ghost was pretty new and like there weren't, we would have had to self-host it. So yes, now we can pay somebody to host it. That changes the economics and the dynamic a little bit on that.
Yes, Ghost was fairly early, three-ish years ago, and yes, there was going to be a lot of back end work for anyone using it at that point in terms of self-hosting, which stuff gets better over time.
Well, yeah. And frankly, I don't think either of us trusted ourselves to self-host something that involves money transactions.
I'm barely confident enough to self-host a Plex instance.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if you're happy with Patreon, we're not changing anything in a irrevocable way. If we do it, we'll run both at the same time and you can choose whichever one you want to support us on. Yeah. No questions asked. But that'll do it for us this week. Thank you. Thanks everybody for sending in questions. This was fun. Not that it isn't always fun, but like it was a noteworthy batch of cues.
Yeah, you make our jobs easy when you send in so many good cues.
The email address is techpod@content.town. You can post them in the Cues Seeking A's channel. We will be back next week. Oh man, we have something really exciting for next week, I think.
Do we?
It might be the week after. It's the week after.
Oh, that's the week after.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll have something exciting for next week, too.
We'll definitely have something exciting for next week as well.
Yeah. See you all then. Bye, everybody.